It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Well, well, well.
Locked in the bunker, shadow shake. One man clapping secrets awake. Board games living, dice they break. Echoes pounding, hearts they quake.
Welcome to the Sound of One Man Clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker. It is Sunday, not morning. I had a lazy sleep in. It is around, I don't know, what is it, midday? I'm back after a week off for self-care and life is good. Today we're going to go through all the games that were, of which, spoiler alert, there were many. I'll share everything that's coming in with incoming, four exclamation marks. And I'll take you through what's got my attention in crowdfunding. Spoiler alert, I'm just about cooked. And we'll spend some quality time with the voices in my head. Settle up. Get comfy. It's me time. This week on the games that were, last week on Saturday, there were a bunch of us at CoastCon. Thank you very much to the guys that hosted CoastCon. It's a small gameplay conference on the central coast north of Sydney. We had a lovely time. It was Sunday. I don't know what was going on, whether I was just tired, whatever the case was. I was feeling really unwell last Sunday, so no episode last week. I just didn't have it in me. I got up, I actually started scripting, I sat down in the bunker, I opened the computer, and I really felt unwell. I just thought, you know what, everyone will be okay. It's just me that really misses it so much. I think you guys will be okay. And I needed a week off. And it was good. It was good to do. Last Sunday, I really just took the day to just take care of myself. A little self-care. I didn't do anything overly special. I played a little bit of Outer Worlds 2, which I'm loving. Love me an RPG. And I don't video game much anymore because board games kind of suck up all my bandwidth and all my love, which I am not complaining about. But Outer Worlds 2 is fantastic. And I've been doing a little bit of that on the side. And here we are again, back at the mic. So thank you for your patience. I hope you've had a good couple of weeks. I know I have. I've played a ton of games, and some that I just adore. So let's kick it off. So at CoastCon last week, we started the day with one of my all-time favorites, and that's Wonderlands War. And this was the first game we played with the Shards of Infinity expansion. Shards of Infinity throws a couple new things in the game. Most notably, all the Wonderlandians, if you play Wonderlands War, it's a bag builder. It's a little bit like if Quacks of Quedlinburg was a game, and I know that's a hot take, because I actually quite like Quacks, but there's not much game in it. You're kind of drawing and cheering and drawing and booing, and that's the game. You have control over what goes in the bag, but not like you do in Wonderlands War. In Wonderlands War, you really have complete agency over the different asymmetrical chips that go into your bag. And you have a lot more, I'll use the word ages again, you have a lot more control over the mechanics and I guess the rhythm in which they come out. Because unlike Quacks, you just go until you stop, and that's the whole round. In Wonderlands War, you've got a few other bits and pieces, and the chips are a little funky. So I love Wonderlands War. I really, really do. I mean, every chance I get to get Wonderlands War to the table, I will. It's a good 3 hours. By the time you set it up, you do a quick review. And basically what you're doing is you start with a tea party, you go around the table in the center of the table. You go around the table in the center of the table. It's table inception. So on the board game table, there is a picture of a tea party around the table. And your Wonderlandian travels around that collecting cards. And the cards give you an asymmetrical sort of setup for the war that is to come. And you do that until you don't. And then you go out into the different provinces around Wonderland and you do battle with your chips. And if you're not battling, you get to wager. You get to have a wager on the people that are battling. And it's so much fun. The Shards of Infinity expansion adds a meaningful drive to taking the first region. It adds extra benefits if you win in the first region of battle every round of war. And it also makes the Wonderlandians, which are these extra characters and or chips that are in the game. So you might have... I want to say the Mad Hatter, but the Mad Hatter is one of the characters you play. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. You have Tweedledee and Tweedledum. You might have the Caterpillar. You might have the White Hare. And what you do is they're either an extra figurine, they're an extra miniature that goes into war for you, and they have powers in war, or they're an artifact like the Rabbit's Pocket Watch. And so you'll have the Rabbit's Pocket Watch that goes into your bag, and the Pocket Watch does some funky stuff. The Shards of Infinity expansion makes all of these a little spicier. So in this game, you have Madness Shards, which are bad. You get Madness Shards through the game, and if you get too many, then bad things happen, and they're negative points at the end. And in the original game, you've got one Shards that are worth one that you collect, and Shards that are worth five in case you need lots. Well, the Shards of Infinity expansion includes these hot pink ones, which count as 10. Now, none of us got them, but we got pretty damn close, because you get a lot more Shards of Madness in this, and the Wonderlandians are a lot spicier, a lot more interactive. They're a lot more fuck you around the table, but in a fun way. None of it's painful, none of it's mean. Well, it's all mean, I guess. It's a war game. But to be honest, having played it with Shards of Infinity, I don't think I'd ever play it without again. I think it's a little bit of a meatier game. It doesn't change the game or add extra mechanics other than that first battle benefit. It doesn't really add or layer anything on. It just changes the way the Wonderlandians work. My only wish is that the art on the Shards of Infinity Wonderlandian cards was not the color scheme it is. And I get why they do it. They do it so you can clearly unpick whether it's the base Wonderlandians or the Shards of Infinity Wonderlandians. The art, I think from memory, is identical. It's this wonderful Manny Tremblay art, which I adore, and I think it's absolutely the 100% right fit for the game. It's this gorgeous, lush, color-popping, vibrant, animated look. And it's amazing. The art is exactly what you want for the game. The cover of the box, this terrifying up-close of the Cheshire Cat, is wonderful. If you're not familiar with Wonderland's War, the art is gorgeous. And so then the Wonderlandian cards, which are these gigantic tarot-sized cards for each Wonderlandian that you purchase in the game through meaningful different mechanics. In Shards of Infinity, they all have like a sickly purple... They're like a black and gray with sickly purple highlights. And I get why they've done it, because you can see it. You can unpick these cards really clearly, whereas the base game cards are full color. I just wish they were both full color, or that there was an option to do it, because the art is so good. Tiny, tiny, tiny complaint. It's not even that much of a complaint, because you don't spend a lot of time looking at these cards. Wonderland's War with the expansion is glorious. I absolutely love it. Wonderland's War, we played that at 4 or 5. I can't remember now. I think we played that at 5. I don't know. It was 4. We played it at lots. It was about 2.5-3 hours. And there's a lot of commentary out there from people who say, oh, it's too long, it's too long. I've never, ever once played Wonderland's War and got to the end and gone, I wish that was shorter. And it is a long game, but I just find the decision space of... Because it's a real head game as to whether you're going to keep going, whether you're going to keep going in these battles. Super Trooper, he absolutely screwed me. Because I put a wager out on one of the battles he was in. He goes, no, I got this, trust me. Bet on me. And I'm like, oh. So I bet on him, and then he tapped out and absolutely fucked me. It was hilarious. All hilarity all the time. Laughed my ass off. I will never forget it. And, you know, it was a great game. Love Wonderland's War. That's Tim Eisner, Ben Eisner, and Ian Moss. Art by Manny Tremblay, of course, published by Druid City Games. There is a new crowdfunding campaign for Wonderland's War Duel that just finished, but the late pledge will open shortly. And I am 100% all in on Wonderland's War Duel, because there are two new factions for Wonderland's War, and very, very excited to see that. It's gorgeous. I have the all deluxe version. Unfortunately, I forgot that I based the minis like a year ago in black base paint. And so they were even shitter to play with than gray minis, because they're black. There was no definition on them whatsoever. It's just these black blobs all around. So I'm going to have to pull my finger out and paint them properly. Now that they've been based, I forgot. I based them and put them away and forgot. Wonderland's War. Amazing. And we had another WW game on the day. We played World Wonders. World Wonders was brought to the table by Project L. She said, hey, let's play World Wonders. I'm like, hey, dude, I'll play anything. And World Wonders is fabulous. Spoiler alert. World Wonders is a tile drafting game. It's not drafting so much as it's a market. You got to pay for these things, but it's in turn order. You're pulling these polyomino tiles onto your board and you're playing them down under strict rules and regulations. And in very rare circumstances, you will have the ability to yoink a wonder from the market. Wonders could be the Great Pyramids. They could be the Aqueducts of Rome. They could be the Menhir Statues of Easter Island. And they have all these wonders that come out randomly into the market. And if you happen to magically, miraculously, and otherwise, through some sort of feat of planetary alignment, meet the requirements and have the space to put them down, then you can put a wonder down. And wonders are huzzah points. It was great. The Fox would freaking love this game because she loves a polyomino. She loves a tile layer. So long as it's breezy. She's not a fan of... what's that? What's the one with the lazy suit? Planet Unknown? Not a fan of... I think it's Planet Unknown. Not a fan of Planet Unknown. Too much to do with the rovers and the meteors and all the bits and pieces. But one of World Wonders, I think she would absolutely eat up. So I may borrow that from Project L in the future. And if she absolutely loves it, it may be one of those that we have a rare duplicate in our circle of gaming. Because, as I said, she loves a polyomino tile layer. It is a blast. It wasn't overly long. I want to say it was an hour and a half with a teach. It's very pretty. You know, you've got all your wonders are 3D wooden sculpts. And yeah, World Wonders. Highly recommend it. That was designed by Zay Mendez, art by Odysseus Stamoglou, Tom Ventre, and published by 15 different publishers across the land. It was published by everybody, right? I'm not going to read you 15 publishers. I don't know which version Project L has, but published by lots of people. After that, we played a game of Shackleton Base. Now, this was, I think, only my second game of Shackleton Base. I think I played it, I think Super Tour and I played it two-player. I think it was a four-player game. I can't recall. I should have that up in front of me. Shackleton Base is a triumph of Eurogaming. I'm just gonna be serious. It is not, when you look at it, it doesn't look great. I gotta be honest. It's not the prettiest. It's not smartphone ink, but it has a little bit of a spreadsheet the game look about it. It's got a very transactional looking board. You know, I remember when it first came out, I looked at it, and even the cover art on the box is like, It's this stylized, it looks like a painting of an astronaut, and it just looks really boring. Now, you know, do I like a great box art? Sure. Are all my boxes shoved sideways in calyxes so I never see them? Most of them. I've got a few boxes that are front facing because they're very pretty and they fit on the front of a shelf, but most of them are sideways. So, meh, whatever on the box art. I do love a game we're talking about, like Wonderland's War or, you know, Civolution or some of those, you know, Spirit Island, they have these really amazing boxes. Oathsworn, they've got these gorgeous boxes. In the end, it's meaningless, isn't it? It could be like cigarette packaging. They could make it a black box with a skull and crossbones on it saying, warning, this box will leech your fucking wallet for the rest of your life. You know, and I'd still buy it, you know. So I kind of understand addiction in my own little way. The box art's boring. The board is not fabulous to look at. The gameplay is superb. Shackleton Base is, for all intents and purposes, a worker placement game. In as much that you have a number of things you can do with your workers. They can go to the crater, and depending on which color worker you send, they can do a number of different things. They can go to this space in the bottom right of the board, which gives you a number of actions you can select. They can go to the moon landing bay. You can swap them for another worker. There's lots of different things you can do, but the game, each round starts with drafting a cluster of workers. And so you kind of have to start each round by going, well, you've got yellow, red, and blue workers. Which of those actions do I think I'm going to want? Because the color of the worker off to the moon crater will designate what it does. So one of them will let you mine resources. One of them will let you activate the presence tokens that are there by the different corporations that are in play. And one of them will let you just collect cash. Similarly, when you send them to the working space in the bottom right, if you send a yellow worker to the yellow space, you get a benefit of an extra action. You can send any worker you like to any space, but if you happen to match them up, you get a little benefit. And of course, if everyone's doing lots of yellow actions in a game down in that space, they get more expensive the further they go along, and money is not fun to come by in this game. You have, much like SETI, you set the game up with a randomization of corporations. So you start the game and you pull out three corporations from the box. I think from memory there are six, might be seven. There's quite a few. And you get three corporations out and they have their own little board that pops out, their own little deck of cards that you can purchase that give you extra huzzas. They either give you an extra action space or an ongoing passive power for the game. And they have their own tokens, their own mechanisms. And they all just stitch together. This is only my second game, but I've never, I say never, it's only two games. But they seem to just overlay, they go in the board, and we started the game, and we had one of these three factions, which was the happy, sustainable green one. I can't remember what they're called. And using them put out these little green lush farms. And we were playing and playing, and we're like, well, why the fuck would you bother putting these out? They just plug up the board. And about halfway through the game, we went, So there's this lovely enmeshment of these corporations that come together. And it's not immediately apparent why you would bother with one or the other. And truly, you kind of have to specialize in the game. You can't really go all in on three. You've kind of got to pick two and thrust yourself down those paths, because picking three kind of dilutes your involvement. And I mean, you can, but the really big points, because these three corporations are the points engines in the game, they come towards the latter part of supporting those corporations. So if you support all three, you're going to get to the 40, 55% mark on their sort of tracks, for want of a better word, which have some points. But if you push two as far as you can, you get much bigger clusters of points. And anyway, not that I'm very good at Shackleton Base. I'm not offering you a how-to-play strategy. I'm just giving you my once-over. I think Shackleton Base is fantastic. Like SETI, Shackleton Base is the kind of game where they can just next year go, hey, here's three more corporations. Little box on the side. Doop-de-doop-de-doop. It won't fit in the main box. Holy shit, that box is packed full. Like, just packed with stuff. Because there's boxes and boxes and tokens and shit everywhere. But they could just go, hey, here's a little box, a little slim box you can sit on the side. It's got three more factions tucked in there, three more corporations. Enjoy. SETI, same thing. They've got their expansion that's, I think it was released at Essen. It's got a number of new alien races, and it's got a fix for the scanning mechanism, which at two players is shithouse. It's a very easy way to say, here's a great game. And all we're going to do is these modules. It's already a modular game, right? Whereas sometimes you get some of these games like, you know, Botoku, for example, came out with an expansion. And it's like, Botoku has so much in the box. There's so much variety in the box. There's, because the way you set it up is randomized. There's so, like, you could play Botoku 20 times and it's already a different game every time. And they brought out an expansion. It was like, hey, it's more stuff for Botoku. And I'm like, well, I literally do not need more stuff. I do not need anything more for Botoku. Thank you very much. That's lovely. But you've got something like SETI or something like Shackleton Base where the game itself is already modular. You're already not using everything in the box. You know, in I think, as I said, for Shackleton Base, there are six corporations in there. You're picking three of them. You can pick them at random, or they offer clusters of recommendations. Say, choose these three because they play well together. You do whatever you like. They just offer three more. And all of a sudden, you offer three more into the mix and you've tripled your whatever it is. I'm not mathing right now because it's Sunday and I'm not doing any math. You meaningfully increase your ability to enjoy the game a number of times without feeling bored. Shackleton Base is Fabio Lopiano and Nestor Mangione, art by David Sipon and published by Sorry We Are French, otherwise known as Désolé Nous Sommes Français. We played most of a game of Dune Imperium Uprising at CoastCon. Now, I say most of a game because we were of the impression, and I believe even the organizers were of the impression, that we had till 10:30 at night, and we thought, well, we can finish this off. And at 8 minutes past 10, they came around and went, sorry guys, we need to be out at 10. So we probably had another 20 minutes left of Dune Imperium Uprising to play, and ended up having to sweep it off the table and go. So Dune Imperium Uprising, I really like Dune Imperium. I've played a lot of Dune Imperium, both solo and with my game group. I think Dune Imperium is an excellent game. I think it's tense. I think it's nail-biting. I think it's tight because the worker spaces, you want them so badly. I think you get gazumped all the time. There's a whole lot of screw you for going where I wanted to go nonsense in Dune Imperium. Dune Imperium Uprising is the same game, but I actually think it's a bit looser. So in Dune Imperium Uprising, they've taken quite a bit of the board away. In that, when I say quite a bit, there's four or five spots that have just been carved out. The mechanism, and I'm talking to people who play Dune Imperium, because Dune Imperium's got a lot going on. So in Dune Imperium, you've got this board you can go to, which gets you spice tiles for upgrades and benefits. That's no longer a standalone action. That's something you can do if you take a green action on the board. You also now have spy locations. And spy locations, if you send a spy, they're these little tokens you pop out and they're connected to spaces around them. They allow you to get into a space if it's already blocked. So it's taken this game that's super tight, super competitive, and made it a little looser in that. And that's fine. That's fine. But for me, the draw of Dune Imperium is that uber tight. You've only got two actions around. And it's the same in Dune Imperium Uprising, except they've taken the Mentat away. And the Mentat was a way for you to purchase a third action in a round. Dune Imperium Uprising has taken that board, which is super competitive. And granted, they've taken some of the spaces away. So they've taken some of the spaces off the board, but then they've made it easier to get into spaces without being blocked. They've also added sandworms, which basically are like trump cards for battle, you know. And if you unlock sandworms, I managed to, through an absolute fluke of a couple of card draws, unlock sandworms on like my second or third round, which I don't think is something that really should be happening from the looks of them, because they just throw so much into combat. And I'm not saying I would have won this game. Like, I don't know where it was going, but I was certainly easily staying ahead of the combat needs without having to invest too much in troops, because sandworms just come in and go bloink. And I was the only one that had access to sandworms because I got lucky. So I enjoyed Dune Imperium Uprising. I think in the 78% of a game that I played, my gut check is that I prefer Dune Imperium, but we'll see. I would like to play it again. I would like to play it to conclusion. I'll tell you what, playing it made me want to play more Dune. I managed to pick up Bloodlines in a seconds auction through Good Games. Thank you, Good Games. You guys are legends. And so Dune Imperium will be on my table soon, because Bloodlines adds more Dune. So that was CoastCon. CoastCon was a blast. Thank you very much. It was a great day. Happy I went. And then on the Sunday last week, when I wasn't feeling the best, but later that day, I played with the Peanut and the Fox. We played two games of Monolith by Phil Walker Harding. So Monolith is, again, you know, the Fox loves a tile layer. This is basically 3D Tetris. You've got these beautiful colored 3D chunky pieces that are Tetris shaped, and you've got to build, basically, it's a 4x4 and then 3 tall cube. You're building a monolith on your little player board. And you got a whole lot of rules about how you're going to score. And what you're trying to do is, on your player board, you've got a color band on each of the 4 square borders. So it might be yellow, red, blue, green. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to collect tiles of that color and have them facing out on the border. So if you've got a green border, you're trying to make sure that you've got green tile, green facing on that side. And then, in tandem with that, you are basically taking these tiles, which are, you're basically betting on how many you're going to manage to get on that side. So obviously the most you can get on that side is 12, because it's 4 on a side and 3 tall, so you can get 12 on that side. Now, if you are thinking in 3 dimensions, if you get 12 cubes on one side, that means the most you can get on the edges that are on either side of it is 9. Because these cubes are in 3D. So if I have 12 on one side, the ends of that side become the starting ends of the left and the other sides. I'm using side a lot. Okay, so think of it this way. I'm going to name the number of the sides 1, 2, 3, and 4 going clockwise around a square. Who cares which one they start on? If I place a red wall on side 1, that means that the edge of the wall on side 2 is also red, and the edge of the wall on side 4 is also red, which reduces how much you can fill the other side, those two sides, by 3 each. Right? So that means the most you can do is 9. If you then fill the opposite of wall 1, wall 2, with another 12, then it reduces the most you can get on those alternate edges again. Now, here's the kicker. There's only 12 bet tiles. So you're going to buy a tile, not buy, but on your turn, you're going to take this tile and say, yeah, I'm going to get 12 on this edge. If you take the 12 and lay it down and you don't get 12, that side of your monolith scores fucking 0, right? If you take the 6 and you put 9 there, you get 6. It is really zingy in that way because you've got to be thinking in 3 dimensions the whole way you go. It's fabulous. The peanut loved it. The fox loved it. I loved it. It's super quick to teach. It's about a half hour a game. We played 2 games back to back. There's another layer on this in that you draw a card at the start of the game that gives you a unique sculpt. It's a unique sculpt in 3D. And if you manage to build that as well, then you get huzzah points. So the sculpt might be the wall, which means you've got to have a whole wall, one side filled, all 12, and then no more than one layer high on the rest. So basically what you've got is you've got a floor and a wall on one side, you get points. So you've got to construct that before you move on to building the rest of your monolith. You also get points as you complete each layer, you get points, and they're diminishing. So they start at, I think, 11, and then the next token is 9, and the next token is 7, and then, so for example, if you are late to the party on completing layers, you will get points, but you get less layers. So it's a constant chase of, am I chasing the wall build, for example? Am I looking to get 12 on this side and grab that 12 tokens? Am I wanting to build my layers up really fast? Because the game's over when someone finishes their monolith, right? So you can absolutely race to get your 3 layers fully built. You get the 3 layers and you're done and you go, because once you're done, the game is done. It's really wonderful. There's a great push-pull, and as I said, it's easy to teach, it's easy to play, it's crunchy, but not, it's not going to hurt you. There's no calico pain in this. This was something I picked up at PAX for, I think, $35. I think it was marked down. I think there are a lot of copies around. It's not maybe selling a whole lot. It is, as I said, it's a Phil Walker Hardy game. Art is by David Ticello, and it's actually published by Simon, which I had no idea of before I bought it. I actually had it in my bag back at the hotel room. I'm like, oh, there's a Simon label on this. I had no idea Simon made this game. I was aware of the game because it came out at almost the exact same time as Tesseract, which was a little indie project on Kickstarter, which I backed and then decided not to. I think I needed the money for something else. This was years ago. But I know Monolith and Tesseract came out at almost exactly the same time. They're very different gameplay mechanics, but they look very similar in that you're building a cube out of cubes. So fast forward. Last week, I was traveling for work. I had taken a couple of games with me, but I have been really shattered the last couple of weeks. I don't know why. I think it's just, it's this time of the year. You know, it's term 4 in Australia. Everything ramps up. There's camps and there's crap on the weekend. And, you know, every weekend out till Christmas is booked with something, which I love. But there's just no break. And so I didn't play many games midweek. But, of course, yesterday was the Board Game Barbecue Spring Game Day, which is hosted, obviously, in spring by the Board Game Barbecue. If you don't listen to Board Game Barbecue, they're a bunch of legends here in Australia. They have a superb podcast. They're also responsible for PlayCon, which is the largest board gaming play convention in the Southern Hemisphere. It's outstanding. It's every July. If you haven't got your tickets for that, here's a plug for you boys and girls on Board Game Barbecue. Go get your tickets for PlayCon. It's at the ICC, the International Convention Center here in Sydney next year. And it is 3 days of so much fun times. But they, in between that, they're kind enough to run these game days. And it's somewhere between 70 and 100 people come. So this one was at Castle Hill RSL, which it's usually at. And it was there yesterday. And of course, yesterday it was myself, Super Trooper, Project L, The Cracker, and Spawn of L. It was Project L and The Cracker's son was there. And we had a great game day. We played a lot of games. It was a good day. It was a good day. And of course, Dean from Advent Games, a big plug for Dean at Advent Games. He has a lot of my money. Dean has an online board game store that's based, I believe, on the Central Coast, which is north of Sydney. He has very good prices. He has a very good selection. And he comes to each of these events with a little kiosk set up in the corner where he sells great titles. And his pricing's always razor sharp. And he always has interesting stuff. And so of course, Project L and I spent some money yesterday. We didn't need to. We didn't need more games. But of course, we got more games, didn't we? So yesterday, what did we play yesterday? Well, we played our usual, when I say our usual, at least once or twice a year, usually at a board game day and at PlayCon, Super Duper gets out Cthulhu Wars. Cthulhu Wars, I've talked about a number of times on this podcast. I really like Cthulhu Wars. It is straight up, no holds barred bonkers. You have these minis, which are not minis. They're great big plastic and they feel like they're made of like recycled tires. These things are bulletproof. At the end of the game, Super Trooper literally just chucks all the minis in bags and they get shoved in a box because they feel like you could drive over them in your car and they just spring back up. And they are day glow orange and safety green and hot pink and banana yellow. Like there's no gray on the table. And they're monstrous. I think, the great old ones are 12, 15 centimeters tall. And it takes a whole table and a half. Like you are basically looking for space left, right, and center. And Cthulhu Wars is great fun. I've always maintained, and I think I said the same thing yesterday, that if you win Cthulhu Wars, you win by accident. Because the factions are all so broken, in the most delightful way, they're all so broken with weird rules that you have no hope of keeping track of if you're playing. When you're playing, you have no chance of keeping track of everyone else's Cthulhu Wars factions unless you've played a ton. I will say there's one dude we played with last year, and he sat down and goes, oh, you're playing with that faction who has these 9 special powers, and I'm playing this one. Oh, we're gonna have fun together because these two play well together. And we're like, what, dude? He knew everything about the factions, and I don't have that kind of capability. So either he's played a ton or he's just wired that way. But Cthulhu Wars, so much fun. It's just wild chaos with lots and lots of dice. I mean, some of these battles you fight, you're rolling 19 dice versus 17 dice. Sometimes you're rolling 19 dice versus 2 dice if it all unfolds the wrong way. It's great. I don't want to go into it too deeply because it is bonkers. You're basically, it's Cold War for 80% of the game. And then it's fireworks as you try and, in the last moments of the game, get as much as you can. You can win this game by turtling, but you've got to really do well at hiding that's your plan from other players, because they will stomp all over you and fuck you up 9 ways to Sunday. It's a beautiful game. It's a stupid game. And I love Cthulhu Wars. It's by Sandy Peterson, Lincoln Peterson, art by an army of people, and of course published by Peterson Games. And after Cthulhu Wars, we played Beige the Bag Builder. And that was Orléans. Now, Orléans it's an older game. I haven't got a year in front of me, but I want to say it's like a 2013 or maybe even older. And it really has that early 2000s Death by Sepia look about it. And don't get me wrong, like there's so many good games in that era. There are so many good games in that era. And games are even getting reprinted. I've got Kalamala sitting on the shelf. It's on my shelf at first still. I can't wait to play Kalamala. I keep trying to drag it to the table. We just haven't got it over the line just yet. We will. And it is beige. It's Death by Beige. It's that, Reiner Knizia palette of, and I'm not talking about his new stuff like Orbit and Silos that looks like Ronald McDonald had a spew. I'm talking about his like 1990s, 2000 era where there was only one color on the computer for the graphics designers. Anyway, Orléans. Look, Orléans was great. It's super fun. It's a bag builder. So you start with 4 chips in your bag and they come out and those chips get turned into other chips and those other chips get turned into more chips. And it's basically recipe fulfillment. You've got a board that's got 9 spots on it from memory. And depending on what you pull from your bag, you are fulfilling those recipes to do different things. I don't feel like I've got the same kind of agency for decision space as I do with something like Wonderland's War. Basically what I did when I played, and don't get me wrong, I didn't do very well. I ended up being second. I did do quite well on this one. Was I basically raced for the wild chips. There's a monk at the monastery, and you could put them anywhere. And so I basically raced those wild chips and filled my bag with those, which meant I always had options, which was fine. It was fine. I don't know what I would do in a second game now that I understand the game a little bit better, but it was loads of fun, and we had lots of laughs, and Spawn of Project L ended up winning the game. He is an uber competitive mofo, and I mean that as a compliment. You know, he threw some label out at the cracker, who's his dad, of course, but it was funny. Somebody's going to correct me. And he ended up winning, not by much, it was a couple of points in it. I had a load of fun. I would absolutely play Orléans again. This is Project L's copy, and she's got the beautiful upgraded chips and little metal gears for the technologies. And look, you're basically trying to build an engine in your bag. I'm pretty tired. But Orléans was great. Go look up Orléans. If you get a chance to play Orléans, it was a lot of fun. And Orléans is by Rainer Stockhausen, art by Clément Franz, and published by everyone over the years. There was like 19 publishers. I have no idea which publisher Project L's copy is made by. But there it is. Just going to take a quick break for your favorite nonsensical ads in the hopes that I can retire at the end of this episode with the influx of income. Oh, welcome back. On with the game. So after Orléans, we played a game that had been on my shelf of firsts for a long, 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 long time. And I bought this. I can't remember if I crowdfunded this or if it was aftermarket. I can't recall. I know I got the Pets expansion. I think it was crowdfunding. Anyway, this is Raising Robots, or basically Wingspan if it was fun. Now, don't get me wrong. Wingspan's a great game the first 10 times you play it. And I still like Wingspan. I think Wingspan is pleasant. I think it's innocuous. I think I don't think it's a very fun game anymore. When I say fun, I would not request it. The only time I request Wingspan is if I think the fox is in the mood for it, because she really likes Wingspan. Raising Robots, I'm going to say it's quite apparent that the designer of Raising Robots was a fan of Wingspan. Because it really takes a lot of its influences. You've got a player board. It's got 3 rows of different colors that you're putting robots in of different colors from left to right. And of course, as you go further along, you've got to pay to get the robots in there. There's a number of different resources in the game. I want to say there are 6. So there are 5 basic ones, and there's duct tape, and there's also batteries. And batteries are not a resource per se. And at the start of each round, you have an action selection process that's reminiscent of Race for the Galaxy. So you've got a deck of these energy cards. And what you're going to do is you're going to flip 2 of them at random out of your deck. And it might say 3 energy and 2 energy. And then you're going to take your hand of action cards, of which you have 5. And they are things like upgrade, design, recycle, and that sort of thing. And so you're going to allocate 2 of these face down to these energies, and then once everyone's chosen, you flip them over. And so if I've put recycle next to energy 2, I'm going to get to do the recycle action at energy 2, and I've put design next to energy 3, I'm going to get to do design at energy 3. Some of these cards have a little cube at the top, which will throw into the central pool, and anyone who's chosen those actions will get a boost, and anyone who hasn't chosen those actions will get access to the action at a level 1 energy. So once that's done, it's simultaneous play. You've got a little inventor that moves around all the stops. There's 1, 2, there's 5 stops. So there's an upgrade first, and then there's a design, which lets you draw more cards. And then you've got the stops on the right-hand side. So basically on the left-hand side of the board, you're basically marching around in a vertical column. You go up the left and down the right. And as you go down the right, if you stop and do the action, so for example, if you stop at the recycle and you do the recycle action, You get to take the action at that space appropriate for the amount of energy that you've got allocated to the action. And then you get to activate any robots that are in that row from left to right. So wingspans right to left. I can't remember now. But it's left to right. You activate them left to right so long as you have the energy to do so. And that's where your battery comes in if you need a little boost to get to the next level of action. Because each action space has a 1, 4, and 7 energy action. And if you have 4 energy for the space, then that means you have 4 energy to activate the robots in the row. And you can spend batteries to boost those along the way. It's cute. The art is gorgeous. The robot cards are filled with puns. You've got little pets, pet robots, and all kinds of stuff. It was really fast. So I think it's 8 rounds, but because it's simultaneous play, basically you reveal your cards and you go boop and you play around. I actually think it's an hour long, an hour and 10 minutes maybe, if you've played the game before. It took us a little bit of back and forth to get set up and started because your player area, you need a little bit of space, and we were on little trestle tables. I think on a normal size table, it would be fantastic, easy to play. I think if you know Wingspan, it's a piece of cake to learn. There's a few other bits and pieces on it, just really with that energy and how the energy works. But I really enjoyed Raising Robots. I'm delighted that we finally got it off my shelf at first. I think it's probably got a little too much in it for the fox, which is a shame because it's so cute. But I reckon the peanut will be able to play it in 2 years. And that is by Brett Sobol, Seth Van Orden, and art by Victoria Fajardo, Howard McWilliam, and Owl Ghost Studio, and published by Nauvoo Games, which is owned by Brett Sobol. Mouthful. Raising Robots. Really enjoyed Raising Robots. Shit everywhere, though. It's cards and tokens and bits and blips, and you got so many little things that so many little tokens. Once you set it up, it's fine. There's so many little bits of shit to get out of the bags and whatnot. Anyway, it was great. And super cute. The art is adorable in Raising Robots. After Raising Robots, I think I got a game of Roth in. Now, Jules from Board Game Barbecue was hosting a game of Roth. It's his game. He wanted to get to the table. It was on After Game. And I'm like, I almost backed Roth. It was a Kickstarter that was run by Chip Theory Games. And of course, it's designed and the art is by Manny Tremblay. Now, Manny Tremblay, a lot of people don't know, he's also a game designer. He's more notably known for his art. And the art on Roth is very different from his typical art. It's got a very, it's very stylized. It's got almost like a trash polka, if you know what that is, sort of feel about it, with slashes of color and slashes of outlines. It's got a distinct feel. It's got a real sort of neon bent to it with some of the color schemes. And Roth is basically an area majority war game. I call it a war game. Yeah, it's with troops on a map, area majority, asymmetrical factions, but not wild, I think. Anyway, so Roth, one is a Chip Theory game. So everything is plastic and neoprene. I say plastic as in not like, it's all really heavy duty, chunky, hold in your hand plastic. You got chips and dice, and there's no dice rolling in this. The dice are only there as markers and for, so they represent some of your troops. And the number on them is basically the health of the troops, not the strength. So 4 of us have played. I enjoyed Roth immensely. I think Roth, probably we played at 4. I think let's wind it back. I'm not doing a very good job today. I'm not out of sorts. I'm just a bit tired. And it's not that I don't care. I'm just a bit tired. So OMC crew, if this feels a little not the depth it normally is, that's why. So in Roth, you've got a faction board and you've got a ton of little basic troops, and you've got dice that represent your elite troops. So there's a resource called Korra, which is basically a little turquoise gem, which does different things depending on what your faction is. Now, at the start of every round, you're going to pop 2 troops out into your deployment space. Each one of you has your own little deployment space. It's one of the 4 spaces around the board. And that's the start. Everyone's going to get one of these unique gems, not unique, one of these resource gems, because they are tight and they are hard to come by and they're very valuable. And then you've got a die that sits on your board that you will roll, and it has a number of bennies on it. One of them is a 2x multiplier, one of them is 2 hits for an attack, one of them is an extra gem, etc. And that is basically an extra boost that you will have for the next round. Then there is a pool of dice, which is two per player plus one, that is rolled, and then you draft. And those dice are your actions. So on there, there will be deployment actions, there'll be troop movement actions, there'll be attack actions, etc. So first player drafts, and you go around the tables, and it's not a snake draft, it goes right again. First player drafts again, you go around the table. And there's always one die left. Now, if you have a person who is in last place, not tied for last, but somebody who is in last place, they will get that last die. It's a lovely little built-in catch-up mechanic. So if you are last place, you will have three actions, while everyone else in the game will have two actions. So then on your turn, you go around the table and you take one of your action die and you play that die, and it might say deploy to, it might be move to, it might be engage in an attack, it might be get a Korra, which gets you another one of these gems that are hard to get. And that's your turn. So you were going to move troops or deploy troops. And the difference is deploying them moves them from your mat to the, from your player mat into the board game, into the game space. And then you can move. And Korra gives you another Korra. And each faction has a number of actions on their mat that these Korra gems are used for. They're a free action you can use at any time. You can also use your little bonus die that you rolled at the start. You have to, it's not a standalone action, so you have to use it as an add-on to one of your two actions. So if, for example, you've got the two times multiplier, whatever action you've taken, you can take it twice. So if you've deployed, you've got your deploy die, you deploy two troops, and you can do it again. You can deploy two more. If it's attack and you want to attack twice, well, attack's really simple. Attack just deals one damage wherever you are. It's not like you're going to roll dice and wipe someone out. So if you're somewhere and you choose to attack, you just knock over one of their basic troops, or you take one of their elite troops and you take the die down by one in value. If it gets to zero, that troop comes off. And that's it. So it's two actions. You have another thing you can do, which is called Exodus. You can spend any two of the dice off your player mat. And if you're smart, you're going to use one of your action dies and your little bonus die that you roll. And that allows you to take all your troops from any one region and deploy them to any adjacent region in whatever way you like. So if you've got six or eight troops, you take the Exodus. You can put two in one space, two in another, four in another, whatever the case is. Whereas normally when you move troops, it's always from one to another. And that goes round and round the table till someone either gets 30 points or you have eight rounds. Eight rounds it ends and whoever's in the lead wins. Now, points are done at the end of each round because each zone on the map has a little token in it that's randomized at the start that has victory points for having majority control. So majority is the straight up the most number of units in the space. And if you are the only one there, you dominate the space, you get one extra point. So really, you're not necessarily playing to hurt opponents. You're playing to push them out of the way or to kill their troops so that you have majority. The spicy bit of this is troops, the basic troops, of which I think you start with are about two dozen, they are fixed so that when they die, they don't come back to your player board. So if they get wiped out, you can actually be stuck with no basic troops towards the end of the game. So you want to try and put them in places where they're semi-protected or make sure you've got some of your elite troops around them or move them around away from some of the more powerful players. I really, really enjoyed Roth. I am glad I didn't back it, only because I don't play a lot of troops on a map game. To be honest, Roth has the same sort of feel when you're playing as El Grande, because El Grande is an area control game. But it has that, there's no combat in it, but it's got some spicy little back and forth. So Roth really felt a bit like El Grande. And if I was going to pick one of the, I would play Roth over El Grande. I think El Grande is a fine game, and that's a hot take because it's very much loved in my circle of gamers. I am happy to play it, but I would never choose to play it. I'd be happy to play Roth, and if I was presented with Roth or El Grande, I would pick Roth. I think Roth has more teeth in it. I think it's more fun than El Grande. I think you have more agency than El Grande. They're very different games, don't get me wrong. El Grande is a beige Euro, and it's a classic, and it's wonderful, whereas Roth is a little bit more back and forth. Certainly at four players on this board, it was very much a knife fight in a phone booth. You know, you are forced to get up in everyone's business very quickly. I think it plays it too, but I don't think I would, unless there's some way to contract the board, because otherwise it would just be claiming stuff and trying to outlast your opponent. And I think at three, it would really sing. I think Roth would be great at three. That said, I'd probably rather play something like Blood Rage or Ankh or, you know, something that's just got a little bit more table presence, a little bit more theme behind it. Roth could be any theme. It could literally just be cubes that you're pushing around. And that's fine. That's fine. It doesn't have to be, you know, I love Chip Theory. I think, you know, it's universally accepted that I'm a bit of a Chip Theory whore. I love their production. I love the things they do. I think that Roth is a good game. I'm glad I didn't buy it because I don't think I would play it very often with other things at my fingertips. But that was Roth. As I said earlier, that is both designed and the art by Manny Tremblay and is published by Chip Theory Games. And the last game we played, it's one of my favorite games and we fucked the pooch on this so hard. We played Nidavellir with the expansion Thingvellir. Nidavellir is a blind bidding auction game with set collection, basically. And it's loosely themed around people of diminished stature. It's dwarf themed. And you are collecting different dwarves in different colors for set collection points at the end of the game. It's really straightforward. You're going to basically, you have a handful of coins. You've got five coins. You're going to play them face down in front of you. And you're bidding for different markets. And if you bid the highest, you get first choice out of the market. There's cards in that market equal to the number of players. And you take a card and you add it to your tableau. There's a little bit of a zing on this one in that you have a zero coin. And if you play a zero coin, you have two coins that you throw in your pouch. And if you flip the zero coin, you get to take two coins out of your pouch. And if you have a two and a three in there, they're five. You get to grab a five coin from the market and discard your three coins. So you can farm stronger coins. The aforementioned copulation of the canine came into play when I said to the table, I'm pretty sure when you get the zero coin, you don't take a card. And everyone's like, oh, okay, no problem. Well, no, you're supposed to still get a card, right? You just last choice for the card. So those of us that followed that rule for the first, I don't know, four rounds, well, we were four cards shorter than everyone else at the table. So really had no hope of winning. But at that point, it was far too late to do anything about it. We started this at 10 at night. So I'm just going to put my hand up and go, it's 10 at night. Like, who's asking me to teach a game in our group anyway? I mean, come on. You guys know better than that. I am the, if I'm not the shittest game teacher in the world, I'm the second shittest. I love playing and I learn pretty well, but trying to read a rule book and teach other people how to play a game, I'm not very good at it. And I'm okay with that. We all have our strengths. Right? Mine is talking to myself for an hour and a half every week and making you guys listen to it. I blame Super Trooper. I firmly blame him because he's the best teacher in our group and he handed me the rule book and expected me to do something with it and he knows better. He 100% knows. It's his fault. 100% his fault. Yeah, I'm going with that. So anyway, we played. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I had no chance of winning, which is fine. I still had fun. Nidavellir is a really fun game. It's quick. It's, yeah, we should play it more often because I really enjoy it. And I'd probably remember the rules. That's by Serge Leguet, or by Jean-Marie Menguez, and published by everyone. Nidavellir has like 947 publishers if you look at Board Game Geek. Those are the games that were. Holy crap balls. 54 minutes and 21 seconds. I'll probably edit a couple minutes out of that because there's some dead air and I burped a couple of times. But other than that, wow. Box was on the doorstep, new delights inside. Heaven's on fire, feels to divide. This week on Incoming! Four exclamation marks. There's a bit, largely because, you know, it's coming up to Christmas and I get to, you know, buy stuff for myself that goes under the tree, and crowdfunding's, you know, thoroughly depleted my bank account, but, you know, I still have organs I can sell. So, things that have come in, interestingly, from crowdfunding, or pre-orders, I'll say, I think it was a pre-order, no, it was crowdfunding, Earthborn Rangers finally delivered, so that's a big huzzah. I spent half an afternoon sorting that out and trying to work out where everything went in the box. There's so much room in the box, I think because they leave room for sleeving. I don't know why I would sleeve Earthborn Rangers because there's not a ton of shuffling going on. And to be honest, you kind of one and done with most of these cards, but there's tons of room in the box, which actually leads me to think that most of the expansions will fit in the main box, which is also nice. So I've got Earthborn Rangers in, I'm going to do some gentle learning on that so that maybe I can get the peanut to the table. I think she's going to freaking love Earthborn Rangers. She is turning into a little junior deck builder with things like Clank. So that's in. Thank you, Dean, at Advent Games. Our exit advent calendar for 2025 has arrived. Every year, the peanut and I do the exit advent calendar. It is a blast. It's 24 little mini mysteries. You pop open a door and it's actually a room, and you can actually get in there with a torch and a little magnifying glass, and there's details in the room. And every day you solve one room to get to the next. We freaking love it. Also, I bought Sail recently. Sail is a co-op trick-taking pirate-themed game with little krakens in it. And Sail Legacy was on crowdfunding it lately, and I thought, oh, that'd be fun. It just looks like, you know, I reckon I could get to the Fox the Table for that because it's just two-player, it's co-op. I thought, you know what? Sail Legacy is going to come to retail. It's not going to be that much. You're not losing much by taking it in retail. I'm not largely interested in massive upgrades for a legacy game because you play it, it's one and done. And so I wasn't overly concerned. Project L was putting an order in with Allplay of late, and she said, oh, Hemis, do you need anything? I'm like, well, I think Sale's got some upgrades on there, so she was kind enough to buy those for me, and then retroactively said, oh, it's a birthday gift for you. I'm like, my birthday was in March. What are you talking about? So anyway, yay! So I've got the lovely little wooden upgrades for Sale. And what else came in? Ah, so Doom Bloodlines. I think I mentioned that earlier. That was a Good Games Seconds auction. If you're in Australia and you don't follow the Good Games Seconds auction house on Facebook, you should. There are some freaking gems that pop up on there. And I've had things like I bought my father's work for, I think, $79 last year. I've had some really big wins on Good Games Seconds auction house. So I got Doom Bloodlines. I think that ended up costing me $30. I also, well, this was yesterday, Dean was of course, at the Board Game Barbecue. It would be rude not to go say hi to Dean and not buy a game. So I bought Sanctuary, which is the Ark Nova Lite, which I'm hoping the Fox might play because she plays Ark Nova. Well, let me rephrase. She has played Ark Nova once and she has said she enjoyed it and would play it again. But this Sanctuary, I think it's just a little bit less. So I'm hoping she'll play that because I love Ark Nova. I'm quite fond of the Fox also, which is great. And yesterday, Pirates of Maracaibo arrived. Pirates of Maracaibo, I managed to find a copy in Jeff Bezos' lair of Doom goodies for a very good price. And I love me some Pirates. I love Maracaibo. And allegedly, it plays really well solo. So Pirates of Maracaibo is in the bunker as of today. That's it. Incoming. Whew! Still have lots of stuff, hopefully, fingers crossed, maybe coming by the end of the year. Managed to pre-order a copy of Recall, which is the spiritual successor to Revive. Revive is an outstanding game, and allegedly Recall is also very, very good. So that's hopefully going to be here before the end of the year. There's quite a bit that I'm fingers crossed hoping for, but we'll see. That's incoming. Postman Pete's been working his butt off. Welcome to FOMO Mofo, where I take you through my personal angst-ridden journey of capitalist acquisitionism. As always, this is not an exhaustive list of crowdfunding projects, but merely those that have my personal attention, either because they are by a design development team I like, a theme I enjoy, or because they have pretty toys. And in my dream world, it's all three. And I'm going to open with, I am absolutely cooked with crowdfunding at this point, guys. Like October and early November, it has just been a spit roast with no lube. And please do not Google what that is because you will never unsee it again. It has been an absolute journey, shall we say. And so this is going to be a quick one because I'm pretty much done for the... I mean, look, I say I'm pretty much done for the year, but you know. So look, things that are worth looking at and thinking about. I've only got a couple here. Terra Mystica, the big box by Steamforge is out. Steamforge is a handle with care company. They are known, and this is not my opinion. I am summarizing a lot of opinions out there. I mean, it is also my opinion, and I mean no shade or disrespect to Steamforge. They are a very successful company, but they historically publish games that are overblown in production and undercooked in gameplay. Look, and I don't play their games for that very reason. this is their first foray into the Awakened Realms model of let's pluck a classic up and do something fun with it. I gotta be honest, I've looked at this campaign. It doesn't look like they've done anything with it except bought the rights to publish it again and are chucking it all in a big box. The bits that, and I haven't looked at it in huge detail, so if I've got this wrong, send me an angry message. I will read it and flagellate myself accordingly. But it really just looks like they've just gone, well, let's do Terra Mystica, a big box. Let's make worse art. Let's charge way too much for it. And look, for me, it's a hard pass. And I think particularly one of the things that happened is they launched the campaign and then 5 days later they went, oh, we've just reduced all our prices by like $100. Sorry, guys. And look, I'm paraphrasing. I think the top pledge got reduced by $100. The bottom pledge got reduced by $40 or something. But it just stinks of profiteering where they were like, well, we thought we could hit you for another $100 US. And you guys have told us that we probably shouldn't have done that. So yeah, here's your new prices. And I'm like, guys, what the fuck? Like, honestly. But that's it. If you want Terra Mystica all in one box with bits, meh, there it is. The other one I was watching was Song of Sylvaranth, aka Sleeping Gods 2 by Red Raven Games. I was vaguely interested in this, you know, and I want to say vaguely. October, Broketober, and No Money Vember has just absolutely just squeezed me dry. And I was watching this because I've enjoyed my time with Sleeping Gods. I haven't played much of it. I started it thinking it's something the Pina and I would play together, and it was a bit beyond her at the time. So it's sitting there waiting for me to reset and us to start again. I think it's the kind of thing that she will absolutely enjoy, and I think it's probably a next year project, but I've got Sleeping Gods still. I've looked at this, and I haven't looked at it in huge detail. I know normally I go down a rabbit hole and give you pricing and all that stuff. I'm not doing that. I am so burnt on crowdfunding at this point, and we're at 1 hour and 2 minutes, and I haven't even sort of... All I've finished is the games that were really... It looks... If you open up the campaign and look at it, it looks like Sleeping Gods. It feels like Sleeping Gods. It's obviously the same art. It's the same mechanics. I don't know if they've potentially tweaked anything to do anything with it. And I'm not sure that Sleeping Gods needed a whole lot of tweaking. I think the gameplay loop on Sleeping Gods was fun. It was a little rinse-repeat. But, you know, most campaigns are. It looks good. It's a no for me. It does come with a great, ridiculous dragon dice tower. So, if you want to have a big plastic dice tower with a dragon on it, well, you have an opportunity to do so. I mean, yeah. So there's that. Look, I'm pretty sure I'm done for the year, but who knows? I'm following a few, and I don't know out of these which are still launching this year. I'm looking at the Iridia reprint, The Paths We Tread, because I think it was fantastic. And I think the publisher for that game is of exceptional quality, and I'd like to support their work because it is a small indie publisher. The Great Library is coming imminently from Vitella Cerda, and I have said all year, it's not for me, it's not my style. I'm looking at it going, meh, it doesn't do anything for me. Who knows, 2 videos in of watching it, I might go, yeah, I need another Lacerda because I've got 5 on the shelf that I don't play enough. Brass Pittsburgh, I don't know when it's launching, I can't remember, I'm watching it. We have both brasses in our group already, but I'll be watching it to see if there's anything meaningfully different in there. Otherwise, I might just leave it. But I'm watching. Snowdonia is launching this week, and I don't know anything about it other than it looks interesting. So I'm looking at it. I will say John Declare has a new game coming this week on Kickstarter called Mystic Lands, and it looks gorgeous. It looks like the kind of thing that the Peanut and Buttercup would eat alive, just with the art. I don't know anything about it. I do know that Unstoppable is on my wish list, which is his last year's Kickstarter publisher, because it is a solo, gorgeous solo gem. I nearly bought that from Dean yesterday. I'm like, no, I've just spent all my monies. And Super Trooper and I have this rolling bro fantasy of adding, 12 Sins of Heracles to our collection sometime next year. So yeah. But I do like John Declare. I like Ruins by him. Unstoppable looks amazing. Oh, sorry, somebody just took a humongous shit upstairs. The whole room shook. So I'm looking at that. That's called Mystic Lands, and that's on Kickstarter. I said I'm done. Doesn't mean I'm dead. I just want to touch on two more things. One, Awakened Realms with some new endgame shenanigans. Like, wow. Awakened Realms with the Below the Asylum campaign. As it was ending, they announced that the endgame would have a little add-on. It's this little... It's called the Ferratic Companion. So it's a ferret, and it's Chaos Incarnate. And basically, it adds this chaos element to your game, and it was only available during endgame, and it's not included in any pledge level, right? And he's cute as fuck. You look at his little face. You go look at it. He's this little ferret. I think he's holding a book. He's this little, and apparently he's like a little douchebag that runs around fucking with your game. Sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways. It was $8 as an add-on, and I'm like, you know what? Fair play, because they gave us a campaign for this where they opened up and went, here's the all-in. And everything they released for the whole campaign was included in the all-in. And there's a fuck ton in that game. So I pledged for the all-in on day one. Everything that was released, every stretch goal, every extra faction, every extra agent, every extra bad guy, every extra mini, everything extra. They're like, yeah, you pledged for all-in. We got you. It's in the all-in. Then they went, oh, you thought you had the all-in. Your game is now incomplete, fucker. Oh, we've got this little ferret. He's super cute. He's €8, and you absolutely want him. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, wow. You gave me the all-in on day one. Of course I want the ferret. I mean, give me the ferret. So I pledged for the ferret. We are now, so those of you that don't know, in GameFound, they have this mechanic called Endgame. So rather than the campaign ending at the moment it's finished, it ends, and then as it's approaching its end, anyone that pledges within the last 10 minutes of an ending extends the finish time by 10 minutes. So everyone gets 10 more minutes to pledge, right? And so if somebody else pledges or adds something or increases their pledge, it adds 10 minutes. Doesn't matter if they increase it by $1 or $1,000, it adds 10 minutes. Well, we are now in day three of the end game for Below the Asylum. They've just sent a notice out saying it's a new record. Wow. And they've now thrown in a new thank you for the 3 days of end game. So Awakened Realms, hats off to your marketing team. Because this campaign, guys, you absolutely killed it from a, not just from a content point of view, but I think for me, if I see it all in day one and it's genuinely all in, I'm so delighted with that. Because historically what's happened is you've backed on day one and then there's 19 expansions that come out over the 3 weeks that you have to add on. So you've jumped in for, you know, $69, and by the end of it, you're $9,000 into this game that you've never played before. It doesn't even have a rule book. That was Stalker, which came out, I think it was delivered this year, but it was, sorry, alarm. And so I started backing Stalker when it came out, and then by the end of it, it was like $680. I'm like, you know what? I don't need to spend $680 on this game that doesn't have a rule book. Now, granted, there's no rule book for Below the Abyss. I really like the looks of this, and I like the gameplay loop. I've watched, there's clearly a rule book for those that have done the prototype work, and I like the looks of it. I like the gameplay loop, and it's not a roll dice and suck it, motherfucker. It's actually a resource management euro disguised as a horror game. And so, you know what? I'm happy to roll the dice. Pardon the pun on this one. And lastly, if you're living under a rock, Tigris and Euphrates is getting a reprint. It's coming next year. With Ian O'Toole Art, it's the same team, I think it's 25th Century Games, that did the Raw reprint. I am exceedingly lucky in that I have two Knizia files in my game group, so I am safe from spending money on this one, knowing and sleeping soundly that I will get to play this one. And that is FOMO Mofo for a week, guys. This week on Voices in My Head, I want to talk small box versus big box. My dear colleagues over at So Very Wrong About Games, they had a Q&A. It was kind of a would you rather session last week. And the question was asked is, would you prefer small box or big box? What would you choose if you had to choose one? And that's not what I'm doing here. But it prompted me to think, you know, what do I love about small boxes or hate? And what do I love or hate about big boxes? And this is just a therapy dump, guys. You know, this won't be a long one. I don't know. You've been hanging out for an hour plus. So we'll probably do a few more minutes. So I just want to talk about my thoughts on small boxes versus big box games. And I'll start, and it's interesting because my collection started, whatever it was, 5 years, I can't remember all those years, five, six years ago, I think probably was when I first jumped into this with Terraforming Mars. It was big box all the way. It was big box or go fuck yourself. It really, really was. It was big box, big box, big box, big box. And to be honest, I have plenty of friends that had small box games that bring small box games, and I would play small box games and be like, yeah, that's fun, that's great. If I look around the bunker now, it's not quite 50-50. And I'm not talking about real estate, because obviously I've got big box games filling two-thirds of my Calyx shelves and small box games filling one-third. But of course, small box games, I get more into the shelf. It's probably more like a 75-25 split now, I guess. I don't know. I could do the math. I just can't be bothered. So let's talk about small box games, because I do have a love of small box games in many, many ways. And so here's the things I love about a small box game. The first is transport. If I'm going over to a friend's house, or if I'm going over to family, I'm going over to the Fox's parents for the weekend, or I'm traveling, or I'm going to a game day, I can throw five small box games in my backpack, right? Spots, great example. I can throw Spots, Gnar. Gnar is a fantastic small box game. I'd even call Nidavellir a small box game. And let me be clear. When I talk about small box games, I'm not talking about Devir. Devir is its own category. Devir is big box games that have been crammed into a small box against their will, kicking and screaming, right? Like, They pack these huge, it started with games like Red Cathedral, which are like, you open that box, it's fine. But then you get to something like, God, of late, you get to like White Castle and all these games, and they're packed and packed and packed and packed. Like, I bought Sand, I haven't even played yet. Sand is in like this tiny, tiny box. And I'm like, dude, you could have made the box just a little bit bigger and I could actually get stuff into it when I'm done. It's kind of like Allplay. Allplay gives you a box. By the time you punch all the tokens, put them in bags, you need like three more boxes to pack it away. I'm like, come on. I'm not talking about like the Devirs of the world where they managed to make a big game box and put it into a small box. I'm not talking about Tiny Epics either, because I've got one or two Tiny Epics that I enjoy. And to be honest, I think the rest are like, why didn't you just make a normal game? You know, like the charm and brand of making this into a tiny epic game is actually annoying in this case, rather than just put it in a bigger box and give me a proper game. Why am I fiddling with a 4 millimeter tall fucking mini that I can't tell whether it's, yeah, the exceptions to that would be something like Tiny Epic Dungeons, which fills 3/4 of my table by the time you set it up. Like Tiny Epic Dungeons, it's got this little box, and then by the time you end up laying it all, it fills the whole table. So again, I'm not talking about that stuff. I'm talking about genuine small box games. I'm talking about the Sea Salt and Papers. I'm talking about Ruins. I'm talking about Land versus Sea. Even things like Century. Century Spice Road. Century, you know, they're what I would call a small box game. So they're easy to move. They're easy to table more often. You know, I could put three of those games on a table in one night, or I can play one three times. The peanut can go, hey, can we play Spots? I'm like, sure. It's ready to go in 4 minutes. Here we go. And we're playing. You do it. You don't have to plan. Small box games are wonderful for spontaneity. They're wonderful for those impromptu moments. Setup time. I mean, it's a small box. How much can you put in there? It's like, poof, let's go. You want to play Paku Paku? We're ready in 8 seconds flat. Paku Paku is a great game, by the way. Easy to teach. There's not much in them. They're easy to teach. Even something like, you know, Monolith, which when I say small box, it's probably what I would call a mid-sized box, but it feels like a small box game because the box is basically just full of these Tetris shapes. Other than that, it's four little tiny player boards and a pack of cards. That's all it is. The whole box is just filled with these shapes that you tip out into the lid and shuffle up. So it's got a small box feel. You can teach these things in 2, 3, 4 minutes, 6 minutes, you know, that's a stretch. And send them a pack down, right? You can pack them down. No, and I love that. It's like, well, we're finished with Spots. Swoop, all the bones go in the box, all the dice go in the box, all the cards go in the box. Off you go. We move on. I think small box games are better at the dopamine per hour outlay, right? Like if you want to play Flip 7, there's so much dopamine in Flip 7. It's the stupidest game, right? It's like, do you want a card? Yep. Oh, you lose. And everyone laughs. You piss yourself laughing. Or do you want another card? Yep. Oh, you win, right? There's no game in it. I don't understand why it's such a fun time because there is no game. It's like, well, do you want a card? Yes or no. That is your decision space in the game. It is so fun. I have so many squeals around the table, so much laughter, so much applause, so much cheering over this stupid box of cards, right? So the dopamine per hour in small box games, 100%. The thing I love about small box games, I mean, there's lots I love, but I think there is a surprise element to small box games because you someone sits down at the table and they pull this little thing out and they go, hey, this is what we're going to play. And you look at it and it's like, well, that is a teeny tiny little pack of something. And you get on the table and you end up creating a memorable experience. Super Trooper and I still talk. I want to say it was his birthday 3 years ago or 4 years ago where we played a game of Spots and he was in the kitchen drying dishes. And at the table, we were pissing ourselves laughing so hard. I think there was a point where I couldn't breathe and tears were running down my face. And it was just one of those moments that is so memorable. You get them in big boxes. But I think because you get more small boxes to the table per hour, I have more moments with small boxes of those memorable, memorable minutes. Those vignettes in my gaming life where I go, yeah, do you remember that? Yeah. Yeah. Look, and the surprise of the density, I think, you know, Buttons and Bugs, that box is so, so tiny. Buttons and Bugs is a Gloomhaven solo game. And yet when you play it, it has the feel of Gloomhaven. A Gloomhaven is a big box of shit. And I mean that as a compliment, but there's like 10 bazillion bits in there. 10 bazillion. It takes hours to set up and play, and the return on investment is so little. Buttons and Bugs is open. You're playing it in 4 minutes. You're done in 20. And you feel like you've played Gloomhaven. That surprise, that density is just wonderful. You know, just talk about 20 Strong, which is Chip Theory's package. It's basically the game system. And they've been able to overlay that on a number of different games. Now, I think there's only three out currently. There's Tanglewoods that's releasing shortly. So I only have the three originals. But they all, you've got the same 20 dice, but they all feel like different games, even though they use the same mechanic or system. And they are able to make them feel like actually different games. So 20 Strong is coming out. We're about to get the Cloud Spire deck. I've heard they're working on a Aetherfields and a Nemesis deck, right? They're working on an Awakened Realms trio. I'm hopeful they get a little Tainted Grail something going on, or a little ISS Vanguard. And so they're pushing the boat out and making things a little wilder. And they're able to take this system and create a tiny box with memorable moments. You know, a game called Birds, I would add that to the list. I just picked that up at PAX. I haven't yet played it with anyone. I played it at PAX. It's this little box that's like 15 centimeters by 15 centimeters, but the decision space that's embedded in that box is fun, it's interesting, it's spicy. Ruins, I played Ruins again. I didn't talk about it. We played Ruins, or maybe I did. We played Ruins last night. When Ruins arrived, I thought, is that it? It's this tiny, tiny little box. And there's so much zing in that box. And I think the surprise of a small box is one of the things I love about it. When you pop open a small box and you go, huh, I see what you did there. That's why I love small box games. Yeah. So about big box games. Because I love big box games. They are impossible to transport. If Super Trooper said, let's play Voidfall, I'm like, yeah, can you come here? I mean, I could take it to his place with a lower back injury and you know, 3 days notice. It's a humongous box. I'm not talking about the And Trespasses. I'm talking just about your general big box games. And if you talk something like Ark Nova, that's easy. It's easy to transport. But the big box ones are hard to transport. I can't take too many bones anywhere. I've got the Trove chest. I don't even know how much it weighs now that it's full. I wouldn't even try. But you know, they're a little harder to transport. Certainly if you're going somewhere for any length of time, you want to take two or three big box games, it's a massive bag. If I want to take, for example, Revive and Ark Nova and Shackleton Base, it's not impossible, but it is a bigger thing to try and get all those things out. They are lengthy to table. So most of these games, you've got to set a half hour aside just to set them up. You know, small box games, you're playing in 4 minutes. Big box game, You know, let's look at Orléans. It took Project L and I a good 15 minutes together to set it up. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying this is a big box game. It's harder to set up. Okay, and they are played less often. And that part of that's because instead of 20 minutes to play a game, it's 2.5 hours to play a game. So, of course, they're played less often. For me, a big box game has a much deeper, much more meaningful and impactful experience. I love a big box game. Now, whether that's with other people, whether that's solo, and I'm not just talking about the Void Falls. I've played Ark Nova solo. It's great. Dune Imperium solo is fantastic. Batoko solo is a punish. Revive solo is a beat your own score, but has the same gameplay feel. It's wonderful. Frostpunk, great game to play solo. It is a bear. You got to get it out. It's 35, 40 minutes to set up. And then it's like, God, how do I play this fucking game again? But once you do, it's 2.5 hours of gut-wrenching decisions. And Frostpunk, spoiler, it never ends well. I've never won Frostpunk. It's like a Robinson Crusoe or a, you know, what's the ship on? I gotta look at the shelf. Sorry. Nemo's War. Nemo's War is like, it's 40 minutes to set up. It's 2 hours to play. I've never won Nemo's War. I don't care. It's that visceral journey that you go on the game. It is wonderful. You know, and it gives super engaging. And I'm going to like just step aside and go, particularly as a solo gamer. I'm not exclusive solo gamer, but I really enjoy solo gaming. If you've got the deluxe stuff, because it's not about the immersion, but it's about the tactile experience and the physical enjoyment of the game. For me, if I'm setting some time aside to play a solo game, the setup is not a put-off for me. That's part of what I'm... It's that part of that zen where this is what I'm going to play. So I'm setting it up. Now I'm doing a rules review. Now I'm playing for 2 hours. Now I'm packing it away. It might have been 4 hours of my life, but it has been 4 hours of zen. It has been 4 hours of a deep, engaging experience, usually some kind of puzzle that is just keeping me alive. As keeping other people alive too, let me tell you, the amount of jail time I've avoided because of the stress relief of playing these board games is fantastic. So, if you asked me, what do I prefer? If you asked me, would I like to play a small box or a big box game? My answer is yes. Just a quick public service announcement, guys. There is no episode again next week. I'm sorry for doing that to you 2 fortnights in a row. The Fox and I have decided to sneak off for a weekend away. We've booked 3 days away. No kids. Our phones don't even work. There's no phone reception. We're in this gorgeous, gorgeous space. And we're going 3 days away. So we're taking the peanut out of school on Friday. She's going to be feeling a little sick on Thursday. She had been practicing the fake cough for 2 weeks. And Friday, we're dropping her off at Poppy and Nana's house. And the Fox and I are fucking off for 3 days. So there'll be no episode next week. We'll be back on it the week after that. Thank you for your patience and your love and your time. You can reach me on all the socials. You can find me on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. You can join the One Man Clapping Guild on BGG. Subscribe to Guild 4426. Send me a message. Start a conversation. I love getting messages through there. You can help OMC by dropping me a like on Facebook or Instagram or by leaving a review on whatever platform you choose. If it's a bad review, I'll sit in the corner and cry and rock back and forth for 8 minutes and then I'll move on. A little bit of counseling. I'll probably record another episode about it just to make myself feel better. And thank you as always for your time. Your time is precious. And the fact that you chose to waste an hour and 20 minutes of it this week listening to how I spend my time, man, it's always humbling. Until next time, get your game on, even if you've got to play with yourself. I 100% endorse this behavior. This week's episode has been brought to you by 3-Day Weekends. See you in 2 weeks. Peace out, mofos. Dice they break, echoes pound and hearts they quake.